Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Still alive, Eric 13. That's me. You're Michael Kester.
I am.
Michael, I'm a little bit sick. A tiny bit.
Nobody's going to know. See, the thing, I learned this in speech class once. If you just say things like that at the beginning, people won't expect as much from you. And so it you know, you call it hanging a lantern on it. That's what you call it.
I do. I also call it a town called Panic. But
so, I mean, fuck it. While we're at it, we may offend people this episode. And this may or may not be the best episode of the show.
True. Both of
other lanterns deserving of mention include Waiting for Guffman, A Town Called Panic, and the 24-minute mark. These are all lanterns. Now it's a roadmap of lanterns. It's a dark night. You can get out your little Pokemon Go app. You can walk through the roadmap of lanterns.
Are you trying to bait me into talking about Pokemon Go?
I mean, lure you?
Stop. That joke is, let me check the calendar, 3 weeks too old.
Yeah, too old.
3 weeks is.
I like mentioning things that people have forgotten so that they go, holy shit, I can't believe that Pokemon Go was such a big part of my life, not 2 days after all those people were killed.
What happened with the gorilla? Do you remember that? Can we be the only ones talking about the gorilla for like the next 3 years?
What happened to it was killed, right? They shot it to death. Nobody shot the alligator in Disneyland.
Now that story is not old enough yet.
That's where justice failed.
All right. Someone needs to send us a message when we forget about this in, you know, fucking 10 months.
10 minutes.
And be like, you guys haven't released an update on that gorilla story.
Right.
So
the powder keg that is the Cincinnati Zoo gorilla.
It's true. Like, there aren't other things happening in the world. The only thing that's happening right now is Waiting for Guffman.
Yep.
Actually, it happened a couple of days ago for me, and I believe 9 years ago for you.
Yeah.
Or right. 9 films at least ago.
Whenever it came out, yeah.
Ago for you.
It's fairly accurate, actually.
You think, I'm going to guess your opinion. You could tell me if I've hit this right.
All right.
You think the centerpiece of Waiting for Guffman is this strange Christopher Guest guy?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I do think that. Yeah, definitely. I mean,
I have mixed feelings on this about Christopher Guest as possibly a misnomer. So that's interesting.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll tell you later. See, okay. I'm telling you things that are going to happen.
Sure. You're putting up the Pokestops.
This is another. Stop it. It's another version of the lantern thing, right? We talked about this on the year end. You just say all the things and then people know they're coming and it seems like you've totally got this.
Right.
Or what happens more for us is that we forget we said we were going to talk about a thing and we never come back to it.
Which is funny.
I feel
Maybe we'll
like,
remember it in a few, you know, years, months.
I feel like on a spreadsheet somewhere, there must be a list of things we said we would talk about in a second. Just completely left behind.
Do you suppose that the spreadsheet should be composed by somebody who will mention at least 7 times on the show this year?
No.
Probably closer to 10, depending on the Beaver Index.
Oh, man. That's the thing we'll talk about later is the Beaver Index. Can I fucking talk about Guffman or what? You have way too much energy for me right now.
You mean the McGuffman?
You need to slow.
Did you hear that? That was a good one. Come on. I need to get a little bit from a Guffman.
All right. So there's a Christopher Guest thing. There's a Christopher Guest misnomer. And then I want to talk about this weird large ambition, small skill kind of thing. Too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let's start with the Christopher Guest thing.
Okay.
Which is your cue to say something about Christopher Guest, I assume.
Well, okay. So it's funny. One of the things that I thought was so fucked up when we were putting the schedule together for this year is that on my kind of mental list of directors that I feel like we cover or ought to cover or are double feature centric type directors, Christopher Guest lives on there. And in my head, we were already at the place where we had done all of it.
Yeah. I felt the same way
when in reality, we've done none of it. debatably Spinal Tap, right? We've done Spinal Tap. A lot of people like to argue that that's Christopher Guest's first movie. As partial auteurists on this show, it's, you know, at least half Rob Reiner's movie.
What was
when looking at those two?
There was a Guffman tagline about Spinal Tap. I said this once before, and I feel like I got myself in trouble where I memorized taglines.
Uh-huh.
And now every once in a while, there's just something flickering around in my head. Okay, so maybe I don't know this one very well, but I think the tagline is something to the effect of from the lead singer of Spinal Tap. I think that's how this movie was marketed. No,
yeah.
Which is amazing.
Right.
Unless I made that up, in which case either it's way, still
it
amazing. Have been
correct. Yeah, that was, it's just amazing. And you get to, you know, try to take credit for it when somebody else says it louder than you. No, so this movie, Waiting for Guffman, is the first Christopher Guest directorial thing. It's the beginning, the true beginning of this string of mockumentaries that have become pillars of alt cinema. And I would say it's a very unpopular opinion because of the film immediately prior to, which is Spinal Tap, and the film immediately following, which is Best in Show. I think Waiting for Guffman is the best Christopher Guest film.
You think that's...
especially today on Double Feature.
You think that's... well, definitely today. But you think that's controversial?
I do think it's controversial. I feel like everybody's kind of feeling Best in Show. I feel like Best in Show is the one that people go gaga when it hits the flicks.
This is something that baffles me about Christopher Guest, and I think makes him unlike anybody else we talk about. Is I cannot, if you told me to point to an Eli Roth fan, I could do that. And sure. I could separate an Eli Roth fan from a Rob Zombie fan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could tell you people who are into rom-coms versus Doctor Who, because those mm-hmm. people look very similar.
I was hoping I know what you guys are up to. Rom-coms versus Rammstein, but continue.
Well, that one, right? That one as well. The Rammstein people, oddly, sometimes look like the David Lynch people. There's a little overlap, a little Lost Highway overlap there. But I have no fucking clue what a Guffman person looks like because every film seems to have its own...
Why do you call them Guffman people?
Guffman? Is that what you wanted?
Sure. I mean, yeah.
Sorry, Christopher Guestman.
Christopher,
that's not good. We can't
guests at the Christopher party?
No, that's even worse.
That's terrible. I'm fired.
I'm voting we go with Guestman.
Yeah, at this Guestman. Point.
Well, so each of these movies seems to have as big a fan base as, you know, a director who's coming out with thing after thing that has, you know, he has a fan base. But I feel like there's Venn diagrams here that are interesting to me. I feel like there's maybe a 20% Christopher Guest overlap.
Right.
And that each film has identically large, almost, fandoms. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but
aware of each other.
Well, yeah. I mean, think about Spinal Tap. That is a movie that everybody fucking quotes, especially yourself being in the music industry. I'm sure you hear that shit ad nauseum. Yeah, I know. I'm just waiting for people on the podcast to scream.
Do you know that November 11th is Nigel Tumnel Day?
Is it really?
Yeah. You know why?
No, I have no idea. Please tell me.
11/11.
11?
11/11.
11. Yeah, November 11.
11th. Yeah.
11. It's a joke about Spinal Tap. Did we even talk about that on that show?
It's kind of, it reminds me of that joke, you know, where you put the baby in the tires and, you know, the old joke.
Right. Oh my God, it kills me. Well, so the Spinal Tap people that you see around and hear around, I feel like let me put it this way. If somebody comes up to you and says the 11 joke, you wouldn't turn around and say the baby tire joke.
Right.
Because
no, you
wouldn't. They wouldn't.
No.
And I feel like 11 might be a bad joke because everyone knows it. So it's not a good comparison here.
But if they mention Harry Shearer getting stuck in the pod.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You're not speaking necessarily the same. There has to be some overlap. There's at least you and I.
Well, and everybody actually involved in the film. Let's not forget those people who overlap.
Sure. So there could be thousands of people who overlap, and yet thousands and thousands more who are fans of each of these films. And I don't know if that's because they are about pockets of culture, maybe.
Sure. Well, I think that there's this level of identity that goes with a Christopher Guest movie, you know, like Waiting for Guffman specifically, that kind
each
of
individual movie rather than a Christopher Guest identity.
Yeah, with the idea of, yeah, how he does films that resonates the same way The Office resonated with people, mm-hmm. where he never focuses on, except for Spinal Tap, which is why I separate it. He never focuses on people who are out of reach. They're all people that you can kind of go, that person may live down the street. Right, they're all eccentrics, yeah. but they're not the kind of eccentric that are outside of your culture, your life, your place.
Eugene Levy is one of your parents' friends.
Exactly.
Or rather your friend's parents. I don't know, right. maybe both.
Or the, you know, the nauseating community theater travel agent couple sure. who have never left the town. Those people feel so real and palpable that when you stick them in a room together, all you have to do is exaggerate just slightly mm-hmm. to realize the absurdity that is something like community theater. Essentially, I mean, the real extrapolation is the absurdity that is life. But this is Double Feature and we don't say shit like that. So instead we say the absurdity that is community theater.
Would you relate to, because you don't do community theater. I've never seen you as a theater person.
No.
Although I think of the actors in our movie, you may be the second best one. So I don't know about that. But do you feel like there's things in your life that kind of relate to this abstractly?
Sure. Well, I mean, I was born in suburban Illinois, which is a stone's throw from Missouri. I mean, the town feels so familiar. Just the idea of this town that thinks it's so much bigger and more important than it is, where you go through. I mean, I've been on so many tours or road trips where you drive through a city and it shows, it says the name of the city. And, you know, it'll say something like Muldoon, Illinois, home of the great chili. And you're like, like, okay, I understand as I'm driving through Muldoon that maybe you think your chili is a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
But let me tell you about every single town outside of Muldoon. They've never heard of your goddamn stool factory. Sure. That's what I can tell you.
Or world's biggest ball of twine or whatever.
Sure. Right? But even that is something that may make a map, but nobody knows why your town, what made your town famous.
Sure.
It's a fucking garbage. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's the stool song is just so funny because it's this championing. It's something that we have done and will do, but are certainly not doing on today's episode, where we take something inane, boring, dull, or stupid that somebody else thinks is really important. And we go, this is really important, guys.
We travel to Muldoon.
Yeah.
That's what Double Feature is.
Yeah.
We go, wow, this chili deserves an entire 24 minutes.
Right.
Let's do this.
We're the traveling snake oil salesman of the rural Midwest. that's our place in life. We are the Guffmans of cinema. We go from place to place and go, sure, this is great.
Well, you know what's funny about that is I found when I go live in those shoes, I really open myself up to those things being great. There was a point in time where I didn't care about Dario Argento or even more so horror films.
Right.
And just knew I got a lot of these coming. And so, I'll entertain the fact that these might be films, you know, but I remember getting on the show and thinking, I don't even consider horror a genre. It's not even, it is sub film.
Right.
And just by spending some time hanging around, I mean, Woody Allen's another one where I'd never seen a Woody Allen film. And then we watched a million of them. Mm-hmm. And now I go, oh, Woody Allen. Someone's talking about Woody Allen. That's a thing I know. I can join that twine conversation. I'm in. Not that Woody Allen is the equivalent of the world's largest ball of twine.
I think to some people it is. I think that there are people who would look at Woody Allen and go, why do people give a shit about this?
Yeah,
this is not my thing.
That's exactly what I mean about Christopher Guest, though. When I think of Christopher Guest, I think of him standing in each of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I think of these places could live together. This could be a stop on Spinal Tap's tour very easily.
I mean, unlikely, but yes.
And, oh, no, I think so.
I think they'd stop in Blaine, Missouri?
Well, it depends what part of their career they were at.
That's true.
And you could also have a dog show here with the same type of people who left here at the end. I feel like maybe mm-hmm. they went on to do other things like show dogs. But for some reason, this isn't like another director who, if you told me all their films were in one world, I would try to believe that.
Right.
I just do not, I guess because they all have such a certain, man, I don't know, a certain makeup to them. So this movie I had not seen. This was one of the Christopher Guest movies I hadn't done. And I had the sense we'd done a lot more of these on the show just because I've seen them.
Right. And they last. They feel like something mm-hmm. that you've just, that they the impression that you get from a Christopher Guest movie is such that it won't go away.
Well, and here's what I mean about that world too, is I've walked by this movie a million times. That is Christopher Guest on the cover, is it
right.
not?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
So he's standing on the cover. For some reason, by the way, if you've never seen this cover, you've seen this cover. But if you've never seen it, it's a blue and green color scheme. And it is his character standing in a field for no reason in a quirky outfit. In a flamboyant, strange.
Shrugging.
Yeah. And doing the Larry David shrug on there. And I don't know what the fuck that has to do with the movie or why he's in a field. I don't know if there's even wouldn't the stage or a theater or something like at least give you a sense of something? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
The person who made this cover didn't see the movie is my point. Mm. But despite Christopher Guest being on that cover, being the one and only thing to look at on that cover, I don't look at this movie and go, oh, a Christopher Guest film. I look at it and go, oh, this is like Stage Fright or Deliria or whatever. This is like, you know, this is like any of these movies we've seen about stage plays or small towns mm-hmm. or things of that nature, despite that the Spinal Tap cover also has them on it. Actually, that might not be true. I'm sure there's some cover somewhere that does.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I know he's on Best in Show and he's on Mighty Wind, and I believe he's on For Your Consideration.
Yeah. See, and
That's it. That's all he's done.
Yeah.
How's that fucking feel?
Five
films, and that's Christopher Guest's cinematic. I mean, you know, debatably, his cinematic career.
I almost think that I want to run the experiment in my head of what if he did each of these films under a different name. And then it came out that one guy did all these movies. Mm-hmm. I think people would know who that guy is better than they do right now.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it would be a huge revelation. And then everyone would go, oh, Christopher Guest. These are all these things we like and see the mm-hmm. other movies. But somehow the opposite thing happened.
Right.
Or maybe I just don't know anyone who likes Christopher Guest movies and just diehard Best in Show fans or something.
It's so weird. Yeah, I mean, people tend not to equate these movies to a single filmmaker, even though you have these performances where it's not necessarily just that Parker Posey shows up or Catherine O'Hara shows up or Fred Willard shows up again and again and again, or Eugene Levy is writing and showing up in every single one of these movies. It's that the utility of the actors are tapped in the same way. Does that make sense?
Sure. Sure.
Where you can tell very vividly in every one of these movies that these characters were, especially as, you know, as time goes on, this character was written for Catherine O'Hara. This was a Parker Posey character before it had a name.
Yeah, right.
Fred Willard was going to be in the movie before the movie had a premise.
Yeah.
I think that's where the cohesion of these ensemble casts come from, because I feel like the wrangler that is Christopher Guest puts all these people in the room before the room is built.
Yeah, right.
I think that the people grow and become the characters in the room as the room's being put together. I think there's an understanding of the sense and the tone of a film like Waiting for Guffman that needs to be both. I mean, it has to be funny. It's a comedy, but I also feel like there's a certain respect when you're doing a mockumentary like this where you can never wink. You know,
yeah,
you
yeah.
constantly have to be, you have to be funny by accident the whole time. Your characters can never know they're funny.
Right.
Or if they do, like Fred Willard's characters tend to think they're funny, but not be funny. And then that's funny.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. But you have to be playing on the right layer.
Yeah.
Something I think helps that. And maybe the thing about Waiting for Guffman in relation to Christopher Guest that I think is the most important thing or the most notable thing is I want to say this is probably the movie that is closest to heart for him. I mean, listen to all the things we've talked about here, sure. right? This group is a traveling theater group. That's who he's making movies with. You know, mm-hmm. if I had to blindly mm-hmm. guess based on not knowing anything about Christopher Guest or even what he fucking looked like apparently when I walked by this. I don't know how. I just, maybe it's the hair. Yeah. Totally.
It's the bowl cut, man. The bowl cut.
It seems like he's doing these other movies with and around some people he knows, but this is the moment he goes, we are the Mystic Knights of Oingo Boingo, and decides that maybe right. Oingo Boingo is a bad example because they never knew who was the Mystic Knights of Oingo Boingo. That seemed to constantly be in contention, but you know what I mean. This is, they formed their group and they said, mm-hmm. we're going to travel on as this type of unit. And you're right. I mean, I feel like these movies start when Guest and Levy are talking and not, I have this interesting script. Who wrote this? Oh, Eugene Levy again. Wow, what a surprise. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
They're specifically probably sitting there going, what about this idea? Or I've had this, or what would you think of this? And sure. so when I'm watching this movie, I think it's, you know, and this is all speculation, but I feel like it might be easier for them to do because they can relate in a way where I don't think they all happen to raise dogs for, you know, as a hobby or mm-hmm. whatever, right? Although that probably came out of some personal fixation or something someone saw somewhere as well.
I just think it's one of those things where you see that, you flip through the channels, you see a dog show, and you just think to yourself, what are those fucking people like?
Sure. Sure. What do they do? Yeah, totally. Yeah. And the other part of that would be the, oh man, we are going to get to all these things. The large ambition that is completely blind to what else is out there.
Mm-hmm.
Or the doing, I almost think it's more that you set your sights low and you put everything you have into it. Waiting for Guffman does not strike me as a movie that thinks it's going to be talked about in 15 years
right.
on somebody's podcast. You know, it doesn't seem like they went into it going, we are going to make a fucking cult film. I get more of the take that they went into it going, let's see if we can all make this film together. We have this mm-hmm. idea. It seems a little more experimental. It seems a little smaller in the way that maybe something like a John Waters film did, especially pre Johnny Knoxville, but somewhere around the Divine days of going, yeah, we're going to make this movie. It's going to be as big as Baltimore. And then when it becomes a nationwide sensation, right. everybody's surprised.
Right.
Which is 24 minutes and A Town Called Panic.
Yeah. So Town Called Panic is, I guess you'd call it stop motion.
What the fuck is this movie?
Okay.
you tell me, I need more than stop motion.
Well, Town Called Panic, I believe, was a children's TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And then it spun off and became a movie. And it's a Belgian-French co-production about a horse, a cowboy, and an Indian who live together. And I don't know what happens, but it ends with fireworks. And
right. Are we talking about A Town Called Panic or Donnie Darko? I forgot which. Maybe I can just save that clip and use it later if we cover that movie.
Right. I can't believe we've never covered that movie.
That's director's cut. That's an in case of
hilarious
emergency in case of Blade break double yeah. feature. Yeah, right, right.
So A Town Called Panic, I don't even remember why or how I ended up watching it the first time.
Damn it. That's the answer I want. I'm I already sorry. Know all that other stuff. That doesn't help me at all.
I guess I thought it, and I feel like it.
You don't
had,
even
it was
travel overseas.
Something.
I don't know it why
just,
you.
It just came into my radar, and I thought to myself, "This is 70 minutes. I can watch that now."
You know what's so funny about that? I don't know if you've ever seen any of these little episodes of the show, but they were 5 minutes long.
Oh, really?
So the only form these guys had dabbled in is let's do a crazy five irreverent minutes. Right, it's so more than irreverence. It's just straight on.
This would be
doesn't
like
make any fucking sense.
Robot Chicken doing Star Wars or Captain America or JLA.
Yeah, except that those things have, I mean, it's no accident that I didn't
it's
think
easier
we'd get to
do.
We'd get to Robot yeah. Chicken so early, but there is a kind of comparison that forces you to go, wait, I'm American. Can we point to something I've seen?
Yeah.
Oh, the short show on Comedy Central with toys. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. But those things have a through line based on their theme.
That's true.
You just do look at something less well-developed. I don't know. Let's pick randomly Family Guy. Mm-hmm. They just redo Star Wars scene by scene, but draw in their own
fart jokes.
Little characters. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then just remake the scenes. Right. So you don't have to do, you know, Robot Chicken starts in an even worse position because they do sketches that are sometimes 2 or 3 seconds.
Right.
And so when they get to a film, they have to tie that together a little bit. You probably don't see in any of their specials, I don't think you see something that's 3 seconds long like you might in the show.
Right.
But for A Town Called Panic, from them to go to, you know, they're doing a 5 minute sketch that would essentially be a long Robot Chicken sketch, not a Robot Chicken episode.
Right.
They're going, okay, well, we're going to have the same characters, not in the same situation, because that's impossible to hold on to, but the same characters, we're going to do a thing for 5 minutes and then we're done. We move on to the next show. And I think they'd only done it for, it's less than 2 United right. States seasons. Right. I don't know what that yeah. means over there, but it wasn't that many episodes. I think all of the episodes combined might equal about the length of the film.
Right.
And so to go, let's do a film now. You're basically going, let's do double what we've created so far.
Right.
And try and pack it in some kind of.
Yeah. Some, yeah. Well, and it's funny
not
too.
Not narrative, but at least string.
Through
us.
Yeah. I mean.
Yeah, yeah,
it,
yeah.
It has a beginning and an end with action in the middle.
I don't even know that I call it a through line.
And I feel like one of the things that I love about this movie is that whereas when typically we talk about stop motion, we talk about something like Coraline, where it's exquisite looking and you can't really even imagine that this is little pieces moving frame by frame.
Yeah.
This instead looks like if Terrence and Philip were live action.
Right, right.
Where the physics don't really make sense and stuff just like jumps up in the air and holds itself for a minute.
Yeah.
It's and none of the actual none of the physical elements could be argued to look really good. Instead, the style is kind of that this is leftover toys and junk that just happen to be in the same place.
Sure.
And nobody there's no parading around, look how visually stunning this is, but at the same time it feels as impressive or more impressive because of the things they accomplish while having this dumbed down animation style. I think of something like the giant cube of bricks on top of the house. You think in a film like Coraline you see that, and instead of going, wow, that's an amazing feat of physics, you may go, oh man, this looks so good. It just looks so good.
Sure.
Instead, in a movie like A Town Called Panic, you go, how'd they put all those bricks on that stupid house? Which you're supposed to be thinking. That's the actual thought that is the cartoon thought, the Bugs Bunny thought, is that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This is silly.
Sure.
Whereas it's if it looked super sleek, you'd just think to yourself, wow, what an inventive and great Henry Selick film is what you'd think. even if it were Paranorman, you'd go, what a great Henry Selick film.
Should we drop Marion Max and Fantastic Mr. Fox while we're doing this?
Yeah, those are
well?
Also really good Henry Selick movies.
I think all of those are so much different than A Town Called Panic, though.
Yeah.
That was my concern when this started, is I'm going, okay, so which one of these other stop motion movies we've done am I going to identify as, oh, this is in that kind of world? And I quickly lost any,
sure.
Hope of holding on to that idea.
Around the time the plot became, someone's taking our walls.
Oh, no, around the time that 50 million bricks or whatever actually got dropped off.
Right.
I'm going, if you had that many bricks to this movie, what happens? I don't even know how. Your plot has obviously changed from whatever you're planning to do with your day, which is right. build a thing. And then I'm thinking, okay, here's our inciting incident then. This is going to be what causes them to go on their whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you could argue that, but then it becomes about, you know, getting out of the center of the earth or, mm-hmm. you know, this snowball thing. I mean, the reason that I think it has so much invention, I'm right with you on the detail thing. I think you look at this and you pick out pieces of invention, but they're nowhere like any, they have more common and more in common with Bugs Bunny mm-hmm. than they do, you know, Henry Selick. I was looking to name check something we either that Henry Selick didn't do and we didn't make a Henry Selick joke about. And I realized there was a sum total of zero there.
Right.
So I just went back to it. But when you had, let's think about the number of worlds first. I mean, I'm not even sure I could list all of the different places they go that you would never think in the first scene or the second scene. You never know from scene to scene where they're going to end up.
Right.
It's like other dimensions.
Well, and I love too that the initial thought process of, okay, now they're in Antarctic world. Your first thought is, oh man, they're going to be cold, or oh man, how are they going to find food? Or, oh man, who are they going to find to help them to get back? But instead, the problem immediately becomes giant robot penguin is making snowballs. And
yeah,
you go,
right.
Why is this the issue in Antarctica? This is so far beyond what I would say, you know, when you end up underwater and your first thought is, oh man, I hope they figure out a way to breathe pretty quick. And instead, their thought process is, there's my house.
Right. This is an exercise I think you and I do in movies a lot, where you see something and there isn't enough of a tie, but you go, okay, I guess we're doing this now. And you just mm-hmm. try and let it go and keep going with the movie.
Sure. And then you find out that it's a really long Batman dream sequence and you could have just discounted
yeah.
it.
Yeah, right, right. Exactly what I'm talking about. The exercise in A Town Called Panic, I don't know if it doesn't last as long or it just never stops, but I did find myself going, okay, I guess we're here now. Okay, I guess we're here now. Okay, I guess we're here now. And thinking about things like how did they get home or worrying for their well-being, it's as if every scene could take place in its setting, underwater, in the glass, in the snow, in the Earth's core, mm-hmm. or could take place in the house, same fucking scene.
Right.
You know, there's no reason to have a giant mechanical penguin in your house, but then again, is there really a reason to have it in the snow world
right.
or the fish people in the underwater world right. who are also yeah. in the prison just appears mm-hmm. out of nowhere. And then they
kind of to your point too, the physicality of this movie makes sense on this super childish level that, yeah. I forgot I could operate on. I'm thinking very specifically of the scene where Steven takes his tractor and he gets stuck in the road because of the bricks.
God damn it, man. I wrote these same things down. No joke. I wrote these exact same things down.
And you think to yourself, oh, those bricks are in the way. And then he uh-huh. pushes down on the gas and it starts coming out of the spout. And you think uh-huh. to yourself, oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess if you... Wait, what? But your first thought is, oh, right. Because if you go through it fast, hard enough, it just comes out your gas pipe. As if
right.
any other vehicle sucks up what's in front of it to propel itself.
Right. 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 Yeah. Yeah. The movie has this.
A jet ski. It's a jet ski tractor. And I think
I was just trying to also think of things that actually did that and coming right. up with nothing. Yeah. It untrains your brain a little bit to get back to that position that is such a trick. When you were younger and when, for some reason, rules of physics, even when you learn them, did sure. not apply before,
this
to
is,
imagination.
This is the land before Mythbusters. Like, imagine a world where definitely. Mythbusters hadn't ruined cinema for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It's kind of a shame that we're trumpeting Mythbusters as the thing that ruined everything
for
everyone.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, as an avid video game player, there's a part of me that gets let down when I can shoot the red can and it blows up now. There's
oh,
just
I don't
a part
even
of me,
shoot it anymore. I go, well, even, I see what you're doing there, red can, but I know that won't blow up.
Right.
Yeah, I think being able to unlock that part of your head, there are filmmakers that make movies. When we talked about Citizen Kane and The Godfather, those guys aren't tapping into their childlike imaginations to make those movies. You know what
right,
I mean?
Sure.
I'm not sure literally at all. But
I think Orson Welles, maybe just because he was 24, was tapping into his childhood thoughts.
Well, yeah. I was thinking that. I was like, maybe when he's trying to come up with the kids
just
scenes.
Because Orson Welles was, in fact, a child when that movie was made.
Thinking about that time he fell into that well with all the bats in it or whatever that was. Mm-hmm. It'd be a different movie. I just assume if I pick a movie that has a Batman flashback, you know, there's a good chance it'll be any movie we're talking about.
Right.
It seems like I've seen that. Yeah. Origin
I'm
story
having
so
Batman
many
flashbacks
times.
Now. That's where right. I am in my life.
Have a flashback to when we did the Mulholland Drive episode.
Okay.
And I'm not going to talk
still
about Mulholland Drive.
Still one of our most talked about episodes.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? For the first time ever, I'm going to reference that episode and no one's going to be talking about Mulholland Drive. I mean, Sharkboy and Lavagirl. The other 12
oh,
minutes
yeah.
of that episode.
That's funny, right.
That was a movie that was written in part by Rodriguez's kids, or one of Rodriguez's
largely,
kids.
Yeah. Just based
probably
on
all of them.
His dreams around. And his thought processes and whether or not he thought he could surf on ice cream.
And I feel like that movie has more in common with other Rodriguez movies than Rodriguez movies do with other movies. You know, that wasn't like, oh man, see the difference between Sin City and Sharkboy and Lavagirl. It's so vast. Although on the surface, it seems like you'd say that, but Sin City is also a cartoonish world where crazy laws of physics are violated, but everybody kind of knows what you're talking about. Or by violating the laws of physics, you get a better impression of what's happening in the moment. It shows the action better.
It also with Sharkboy and Lavagirl, this is actually really a good point, is that this narrative.
Congratulate yourself before you say the thing. That's
what? I was congratulating you.
Oh, well then, actually, let's go back and do some more of that. I thought you were like, I'm going to make a good point, so listen
up. No. I think that that shoestring narrative where we get so caught up in the cinematic tropes like foreshadowing, aka hamster style.
Sure.
All these things, we expect round, complete cyclical plots, stories, films that, you know, just like a stand-up comedy routine where your last joke references the funniest joke that you told one quarter of the way through the whole gig.
Yeah.
We expect that from a movie. We expect that when we find out who the killer is, it's someone who we've seen before and not just from Usual Suspects. It's just so interesting to look at Sharkboy and Lavagirl and to look at A Town Called Panic. And by the time we get to the end, there's no mental Olympics we could have gone through that would have gotten us there.
Sure.
Because there's no clear linear rules that are being followed or set up. There are no poke stops along the way to get us through that roadmap. It's just completely and deliberately random.
When you deleted the Pokemon Go app off your phone, you closed off the child part of your mind. I want you to know that. I want you to know that's what hitting that little X did.
See, that's the thing is, you say that, but everybody playing Pokemon Go is 30. That's what I say back to you.
They've all been hit by cars at this point. I don't know why this is so funny this week. I have no idea. It's the cough medicine, probably. I thought about Sharkboy and Lavagirl because I was thinking about Rodriguez and how he generally makes movies from having that childlike mindset anyways, let alone a movie that was, you know, invented by his kids showing you even more of that. And then you get to A Town Called Panic, and this is a movie that, as far as I know, is just some adults doing it like sure. children would have written it.
Kind of like, say, Waiting for Guffman, just some adults just goofing around for...
doing it like a high school play, maybe. Yeah. But I think this is even, this is 10 years before high school. Mm-hmm. This is when people get two action figures that don't live in the same universe sure. and just they fly around and do crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's
obviously... Or they have one action figure and then just some pig from some toy that they broke. And now the pig is anthropomorphized as the sidekick or best friend of your Ninja Turtle that does a backflip. Hypothetically, not necessarily something anybody's
learning
ever.
More about you than I really need to know, I think. Let me put these in the show notes here. This will be very important to reference again in the future. I think they use toys, and this is a little bit of what Robot Chicken was going for, but I think that ended up evolving to more of a nostalgia mindset mm-hmm. than keeping that childish creation, where when you watch kids play with toys, nothing has to make any sense. And as soon as they get bored of one place, they just jump to another place. They have this mm-hmm. sort of ADHD for the movie.
Right.
And that seems a lot more measured here, which is also interesting to me, that it doesn't require a brain permanently in that state, that you don't have to fall in or out of the filmmaker camp of this person thinks like a child or this person thinks like an adult. You can deliberately go in, look at the characters in this. I'll try and give an example of this because I know it's not going to make any fucking sense. When you look at every character in this movie, I think it's a sign that the movie absolutely knows its own, it knows what it's doing. It's not just an accident by people with crazy heads, but it knows what it's doing because each and every character, there's no character in this that goes, hold on, I've got this. Mm-hmm. Every character is purely alarmed by their situation. And unless the situation calls for alarm, and then they're not, right? And they dart off in different directions. It seems, and it's A Town Called Panic. Mm-hmm. That's characters panicking is what that is. Everybody going, I don't know what to do. This is terrible.
Sure.
It's as if every statement ends with, oh no, this thing is happening. Oh no, we're over here. Oh no. It's never, we're over here, so we need to do this. We're over here, so this is going to happen. Or let's think about how to do this. There's no forward momentum. There's just arms waving in the air in panic, scene after scene after scene. And seeing people just run around with their heads on fire turns out to also be a way to make a movie that just doesn't stop. It just allows it to keep going. I think they could have done another half hour of movie if they, if that were the challenge. I don't think that they had a story to tell and it turns out it takes 70 minutes. I think that they just went, I don't know, what's a film? 70 minutes? Yeah. All right. Well, you got 70 minutes. We can fuck around in the garage and just do whatever. No, there's no way this film took 70 minutes. It probably took 5 years to make. And we had something like this. This just shows the power of all agreeing to do something you don't really believe. When we did the double feature movie, I don't know if you remember this, but this was my favorite thing. And I think I've talked about this on the show before. We would come upon situation after situation when we were filming the movie that was the death of the movie. It was reason we couldn't do this and we had to give up that minute. And these were situations like, we're running out of daylight. One of our actors isn't available. One of the three actors in the movie isn't available. Mm-hmm. I got there and we didn't even know what we were shooting or where.
Right.
We didn't have a fucking ending for the thing. We're writing it during the day.
Things like that.
Right. We drive to the first location and it's not a location.
Right.
And we decided at some point, and I think I said this to Hannah because of all, it was sort of her responsibility. You and I were thinking, okay, well, what has to happen in this scene? What are we making? Blah, blah, blah. And it was Hannah's responsibility to kind of go, hey, you guys realize we don't have any of that and you're running out of time and this is all. She had kind of the AD role in that. And I told her, as a principal, every time you have a piece of terrible to deliver, you need to preface it with good news and then say the thing.
Yep.
And so it would be good news. That mall no longer exists and we can't shoot there.
Yeah.
There was no spin on it. You didn't have to come up with a reason that was good. You just good say news, good news.
The
in
battery
front of it.
Actually didn't charge, so we have to go back to the house.
Good news. I lost my wallet in the woods and the park is closed. And yeah, right? I mean, I'm just now remembering fucking everything that went wrong.
All the good news. Yeah.
But the exercise, I mean, I kind of did it as a dark joke at first, but I feel like it really kept things light.
Sure.
It really was always a fucking joke when that happened. Mm-hmm. And just the power of us saying that, even though we all knew it wasn't true, the power of ending every scene and, oh no, knowing that that doesn't advance your plot.
Sure.
That doesn't, this is or is not a real problem. Just having that mission statement puts you in a headspace and really in a lot of ways, I think allows this world to exist at all.
Right. Well, and I think it also provides kind of a comedic backbone because if there's this mandatory idea of why is this a problem? You know, the oh no, but why? You're forced to come up with these greater and more grandiose explanations. Well, why is it a problem that they're here? Well, because there's a giant mechanical penguin. Why is there a giant mechanical penguin? Why is that a problem? Because it's run by crazy evil scientists. Well, why is that a problem? What are they doing wrong? They're throwing snowballs at deer.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you'll notice they don't have to often bring up the entire backlog of things. They don't have to go, well, you see, we're here because of this and we have to fight this thing because ultimately we need our walls and that's why we're here so that we can get back to the birthday thing. That line of logic, I don't know if that ever happens.
Finding the walls, I feel like, is just happenstance within the plot. To come upon the walls again was by no means something the audience was waiting to find.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think every time there was a space to breathe, when there was dead air in the movie, someone would just go, wait, the walls. And that would just sort of be, oh, I guess we're going to get back to that now because nothing else is wrong.
That's almost a cyclical thing that the average audience is waiting for. Almost.
Yeah, right. Oh, yes. What were we doing here in this? Our cyclical thing is
we have a website. That's doublefeature.fm.
I've never been to that. I don't use that.
It's good. There's this cool search feature. It predicts what
there
you're going to
type. There is a search. Oh, can I tell you a thing about the website really quick?
Yes, I can.
All of the, thank you, Kickstarter, all of the old episodes that aren't going to the distributor this year are back on the website. I believe that's all of year 4 and year 5.
All right.
Awesome. Go get those.
Cool.
What are we doing next time?
Well, what we're doing next time is...
Seth Hanasek, Liam Duffy, Christopher Peterson, Jeremy Mumenthaler, Athena Banks, Tom Comey, Jill Moriarty, Eric Tachek, and Charles Crawford made the show possible.
Thank you guys. Thank you guys. If you have a problem with any of the ways Eric pronounced your name, that's doublefeature@icloud.com, except it's actually doublefeatureshow@icloud.com.
If you have a problem with Michael's ability to remember our email address.
I'm sorry.
What are we doing? Tell me.
Next week, we're doing some hysterical women out of their element. And I know that's really not okay to say.
We'll fix it next time.
We're bringing Woody Allen back with Blue Jasmine. We're sticking that next to this really obscure, kind of weird sci-fi movie called The Congress. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.